Many followers of Jesus express anxiety about talking to other people about their faith because they're afraid of appearing stumped and inadequate in the face of the big questions that might be thrown back at them. And the biggest of those questions is usually, why is there suffering in the world if God is so loving and powerful? Now, if we're honest about it, the real reason that most of us are anxious about this question of unfair suffering has very little to do with evangelism. The real reason is that the question haunts and disturbs us too. It's not so much that we can't articulate a persuasive answer for other people, it's that we're not sure if we have an adequate answer for ourselves. It doesn't add up. We preach good news of a God who is loving and just to everyone, and yet we look around us and we see good people being struck down by horrible tragedies. We see sick children, we see babies die for no apparent reason, or in this week's news, sometimes for reasons of negligence and failure within the healthcare system that we trusted. We see people fleeing places of violence and fear and being unable to find a place of refuge and welcome. We see aeroplanes full of ordinary people shot out of the skies or just fall out of the skies. We see people falling into the grip of crippling illnesses or addictions. We see people living in fear of members of their own families. As Casey Chambers once sang, if you're not pissed off with the world, you're just not paying attention. For many, many followers of Jesus, this is the biggest area of doubt that plagues us. We keep hoping it's going to become clear to us before the nagging uncertainty becomes too much for us and we lose faith completely. At the root of this question, there is a combination of fear and a very real problem of belief. Most of us believe at some level that life either is or should be fair. Every time we cry out, what have I done to deserve this? We reveal a primal conviction that we should all get what we deserve and only what we deserve. Good people should experience good things in life, and evil people should suffer for what they have done because that's what they deserve, and God should see that it is so because that's God's job. And of course, we may be looking at this from either of two quite different stances, or perhaps somewhere in the middle, but the desire is the same. We may be comparatively safe and healthy and prosperous, in which case we want to believe that we deserved this and that we are able to control things and secure our privilege by continuing to be good people and behaving in ways that will ensure that we remain deserving. In a mathematically predictable universe, we can control our destinies by properly managing our behaviour. I do the right thing by others, so life will do the right thing by me. Or we may be at the other end of the spectrum where life seems to have completely turned to shit. Death, illness, unemployment, injury, betrayals, failure, anguish. Life seems to be nothing but pain and unanswered prayers for help. And none of it seems in any way fair or deserved. And we either continue to believe that life is predictable and just and find ourselves torn apart by guilt over not even being able to recognise the terrible evils that we must have committed, or we find our whole faith system with its mathematical certainty crashing down around us in a pile of despair. Tonight's reading from the Hebrew Scriptures was the third in a series of four from the book of Job. And the book of Job is a 42-chapter argument about this question of suffering. It is pretty much the sole focus of the book of Job. So rather than just look at tonight's little extract, I want to have a go at speaking about the whole book tonight. Because don't worry, I'm not going to go one chapter at a time. But I want to try and address the book, because I haven't actually preached on Job ever, I don't think, or not for a long time anyway. If you've been following the daily readings, you'll have a better feel for the overall flavour of the book. But let me give you a little tiny potted summary and then reflect on our big question again in light of it. The vast majority of the book, chapters 3 to 41, records a long and anguished discussion between Job and four of his friends who are trying to come to terms with Job's suffering. Both Job and his friends are operating from the assumption that life is or should be fair and just. So Job's friends, Job's friends are trying to persuade him that he must have sinned terribly to have deserved this suffering, and that he should admit his sin and repent and become a good person again, whereupon God will end his suffering. Job, on the other hand, continues over and over again to protest his innocence, and he's angry at God for failing to keep him and his loved ones safe. And in the end, God speaks to them, and we heard part of God's speech tonight. And I'll come back shortly to what God says. But the other part of the book, which is the first two chapters and the very last chapter, were probably originally a separate story because they have a quite different style and they sit a little awkwardly with the rest, both in terms of the narrative flow and in terms of the theology. But they're also the best known parts of the book. They describe a scene in heaven where God and the Satan are kind of more or less placing bets on Job's ability to stay faithful if he is subjected to terrible suffering. There are all sorts of troublesome implications that could be drawn if we take that picture as literal historical truth. But in essence, it is one of the book's two differing attempts to address the big question. And basically it says that this is not a perfect world where God is in control of everything. There are other free actors in the world, both spiritual and human, and some of them act malevolently. And therefore, suffering can come randomly and in ways which are totally unfair and undeserved. Now, the longer middle section would pretty much agree with that simplified version of the conclusion, not necessarily some of the other tangents you could take it on, but with that basic summary. But the longer middle section works it all out in more subtle and sophisticated ways as the four friends carefully articulate their beliefs that our experiences in this world are a just reflection of what we deserve. And Job maintains that he has always believed that too, but that his case proves that it's clearly not working. And in the end, God speaks and, in the potted summary version, essentially says, Job is right, the friends are wrong. And Job's suffering is undeserved and unfair. Of course, the story of Jesus restates that conclusion in no uncertain terms. Even if you are the absolute model of perfection, the world can still turn on you and crucify you. And in fact, Jesus suggests that the more closely you follow in his footsteps of perfect love and grace, the more likely it is that you will suffer unjustly. So God tells Job and his friends that Job's suffering is not fair, but to the dissatisfaction of generations of Bible readers ever since, God doesn't really give an explanation of why there is suffering in the world. A rough summary of what God says would be that we have very limited capacity to see or understand the big picture complexities of the world, so we're never going to be able to make sense of the injustice of life. And kind of left there. So there's good news and bad news here. If you're suffering, the good news is that it does not mean that you're a bad person and that you deserve this. But the bad news is that there's no guarantee that life will not continue to kick you while you're down, as it did for both Job and Jesus. And if you are currently happy, healthy, and prosperous, the bad news is there is no guarantee that that will continue, no matter how good or careful you might be. Life can be random and utterly unfair, and it could cut you down unfairly just as easily as the next person. Naturally, we will continue to feel confused and angry whenever that happens. We will, at least some of the time, shake our fists at God like Job did and demand that God set things right. And another bit of good news is that although things may not be put right, God does not regard our angry fist waving as a sin or an offence. The God who speaks from the whirlwind to the fist waving Job says that Job has spoken rightly of God. God is far less complimentary about the friends who, like good little evangelists, were desperately trying to defend God against the big questions and assure others and probably themselves that God was still in control and everything was as it should be and it's all fair and just. It is Job, not them, who is said to have spoken rightly of God. We continue to rage against the injustice because we so yearn for a world where all of us can be safe and happy and healthy. We long for a way to exercise some control and to secure our own destinies. We long to know that there is someone in charge who is ensuring that it all works out as it should be. We often fail to recognise the flip side of that, the be careful what you wish for consequences. We easily forget that if God really was a completely inflexible judge who dealt out perfectly fair mandatory sentences to ensure that everyone was punished exactly as they deserved, that none of us would get off lightly. We can end up wanting God to dispense mercy to us and our loved ones and punishment to everyone else. We very easily slide into wanting our own domesticated God who singles us out for special protection and gives us what we want. Did you hear the first thing that James and John said to Jesus in tonight's gospel reading? Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Don't we all? It could almost be a summary slogan of much of modern-day consumer-oriented religion. Sign up as one of us, pay here, and in our mathematically perfect and predictable universe, we have a God for you who will do whatever you ask. But that is not the God of Job, and it's not the God of Jesus. And according to Jesus, there is no such personal patron God. Jesus does not and never has promised that if we follow him, everything will always go well for us. In fact, he promises that evil and malevolence are likely to strike with greater ferocity at those who follow him in offering unbounded love and generous hospitality to those others want to reject. But Jesus does promise that your suffering need not lead you into self-condemnation as though you deserved it. And he does promise that he will be with you in the midst of it, even when you feel utterly forsaken, even to the end of the world. And he does promise and demonstrate that tragedy and suffering do not have the last word and cannot defeat the emerging culture of God's love and mercy. He shows us that the pathway of unjust suffering, the pathway through the valley of the shadow of death, the way of the cross, will emerge from even the darkest and most horrible places into the wide open spaces of the promised land of God's love and life. Jesus has walked that path before us and walks it now with us, and he has shown us that it leads to resurrection. And that won't make the tragedies hurt any less, and it won't give any neat answers with which to defeat Job's friends or knock them dead as evangelists. But it will give us a little fragile light of hope by which to keep putting one foot in front of the other on the path of life. And it will enable us to find solidarity with other pilgrims and sufferers. And here at this table, we find ourselves united with them as we pause to find nourishment on the way together. Here we find the broken, suffering Jesus offering himself to us again and saying, "Take, eat, drink, feed on my word, on my life, on my hope, and together we will make it through this and beyond, and the new world of life and love will be found."